Hi, this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. It's only Tuesday, and it seems like we've already had a week or so of news. Let's start with a tragedy in Israel. The Israelis accidentally set off a strike that killed seven of Jose Andres' World Central Kitchen employees. These people, I think, are angels, and most people feel the same way. It is an enormous tragedy, and of course, Israel bears responsibility. Bibi Netanyahu got out there and said, well, this is war. This happens. This is why you need to curtail war. This is why you need to bring it to a close, because innocents are harmed. It's bizarre thinking. It's absolutely maniacal thinking that Israel simply goes on without a concern for the damage they're doing along the way, without concern for the damage they're doing to their own reputation. But this is only a stunt, I believe, at this point, this continual, ongoing, grinding war for him to stay in power. And this invasion of Rafah, the administration, our administration, hasn't heard any plan for it. I don't know that he has a plan for this. Again, if he simply delays, he talks tough, he promises a invasion to end Hamas once and for all, then his right-wing coalition sticks together. He makes the Americans upset, which in turn draws his coalition even closer, and he stays in power. We've got to put an end to this. We've got to put our foot down. We have to demand not simply an Israeli investigation, but an international investigation. And we have to level with them. At some point, the war becomes disproportionate to the harm they are doing as measured against the security they are gaining. That's when you get into the realm of war crimes, when you are disproportionately hurting innocents for very little in return. And we're really getting to that point with Israel. Whether Biden can force the issue or not, I think there is growing alarm in Congress to cut off military assistance, and there is growing pressure to speak out even more forcefully in favor of a negotiated end to the war. Now, granted, Hamas has to tango as well. You can't have a ceasefire without both sides. But frankly, the Israelis have been just as much of an impediment to peace as Hamas has been. And they have to give up on this notion that they're going to fight forever and rid the area of every single Hamas fighter. You can't do it without a disproportionate amount of harm coming to others. We also yesterday, on Monday, had the Florida Supreme Court decision. They actually made two decisions. One was to say, you know, that Constitution, the state constitution we have that we used to say protected privacy, it doesn't really protect privacy. We're taking that away. In the short term, that means that the 15-week ban that was in place previously comes back. But it also means that the 6-week ban that Ron DeSantis enacted so he could one-up Trump on the forced birth crowd, that is likely to come into play. A 6-week ban. Many, many women do not know they are pregnant at 6 weeks. You are essentially banning all abortions. But interestingly enough, the same Supreme Court agreed that there should be a ballot measure that will also appear on the November ballot, along with the presidential race, along with the U.S. Senate race, where Rick Scott is running for re-election. And that would guarantee access to abortion. It would essentially say the state cannot ban it. It cannot prevent women from making this decision. So now you have the perfect battle. Do you want to adopt the right-wing world in which no woman can obtain an abortion even before she knows she's pregnant? And on the other hand, do you want a world in which women get to choose, women get to make health decisions, doctors don't run around afraid that they're going to be thrown in jail if they treat a miscarriage, for example. Women don't have to wait until they are death door before obtaining health care. That's the choice. And it is so clear in Florida. It is front and center. And I think the Biden team understands this. They were very, very fast off the gun. This morning, they put together a press call. Both the vice president and the president put out statements deploring the portion of the Supreme Court decision that would enact effectively the six-week ban. This is presenting the choice, and this choice is going to be presented all across the country. In some places like Arizona and Montana, there will be a measure on the ballot that will drive outcome. But it's really going to be on the ballot in all 50 states. And that's because if the Republicans get back in power, they've not been shy. They want a nationwide abortion ban. Whether it's 6 weeks, whether it's 15 weeks, it doesn't really matter. They want to take this role away from women, away from doctors, and we are going to face tragedy after tragedy like we've seen in Texas, where women are come right up to the brink of death because they have to be sick enough to justify a abortion to save their lives. You're going to see more and more OBGYNs refuse to treat pregnancies. You're going to see primary care doctors disappear from many areas. It is going to be a tragedy for the whole country. And that is on the ballot in 2024. By the way, there couldn't be a worse issue for Republicans. They are the proverbial dog that caught the bus, because there's a recent poll out from Fox News. An all-time high of people say that they favor little or no regulation on abortion. And in fact, the people who want absolutely no regulation is also at a record high. And oh, by the way, they don't like the six-week and the 15-week bans either. They see right through that. So you've got an issue which is overwhelmingly unpopular, and that's what Republicans are going to run on. This is why I'm a little bit more optimistic than the average commentator these days, because that is going to be central to the campaign. Lastly, we also had another run-in in New York court system with Donald Trump, of course. Now, if you remember, a few weeks back, Judge Juan Merchan, who is the judge presiding in the falsification of business records case, a criminal case, issued short-term a gag order. And that prevented Trump from attacking court personnel, from attacking jurors. So what did Trump do? He instantaneously went out there and started passing rumors, threatening, vilifying the judge's daughter. Yeah, the daughter. What did Alvin Bragg do? He did the right thing. He said, could you maybe clarify your prior order? Does this apply to family members? Now, of course, he didn't think it applied to family members. He was inviting the judge to amend the gag order, and he did. He wrote a five-page opinion that really blasts Trump, that takes him to task for trying to delegitimize, trying to threaten the entire legal system. And boy, is he right. It is entirely intolerable that anybody, let alone someone running for president, should do this, should be able to impugn the integrity of the judge, should be able to threaten family members. And as the judge points out, Donald Trump has the ability to mobilize millions of people, some of them completely unbalanced. And we've seen that. We've seen death threats against other judges. We've seen how prosecutors have to have round-the-clock security. That is the world in which Donald Trump operates, the world in which he thinks he's absolutely above it all, where no rules apply to him, where any interference with his, quote, First Amendment rights is a grave injustice, and he becomes a martyr. I got news for him. Criminal defendants out on bail do not have unlimited First Amendment rights, and he is out on bail, don't forget. He can be fined, he can be held in criminal contempt if he violates this, and ultimately he can be incarcerated. Now, do I think he's going to be incarcerated? No. But I do think we're going to see a series of fines and escalating punishments because Donald Trump cannot control himself. He is incapable of behaving like a normal person. He is incapable of containing his rage, and he's going to do this over and over again. And in the courtroom, do you think he's going to be able to sit there with his mouth shut, calmly, as evidence comes in day after day, week after week? I don't. I think he's going to blow. I think he's going to be a constant, belligerent, outspoken, complaining, whining, protesting figure in that courtroom. And I got to think, a New York jury is not going to like that. Why can't he just sit there and behave himself, even in this context? And when he does that, he simply confirms to jurors that this is a guy who thinks the rules don't apply to him. And they would be right in making that assumption. Well, the good news is we're coming up on jury selection. Yeah, next week, mark your calendars. You should do your taxes because your taxes are due next week too. But the real big date is April 15, and that's when we're going to get this thing underway. Now, will Trump try to pull off some last-minute stunt to delay, to make excuses why he can't go to trial? Of course he will. But I don't think it's going to work. I think he is finally going to be facing the music. And isn't that a pleasant change of pace? President Biden has argued that he is the most pro-union president in many decades. And in a lot of ways, you have to agree with that. He was the first president, at least in my lifetime, perhaps ever, to go out on a picket line. He has made special efforts to engage unions. His infrastructure plan, for example, points the way towards more union jobs. His other economic platforms are very much directed at people who don't necessarily have college educations. That is kind of the bread and butter of what used to be the Democratic Party, which was what they used to call the working class, or sometimes we now call the middle class. But that's been his focus. And despite all of that, he hasn't gotten, I think, as much credit as he deserves. And the Democratic Party still struggles to get its message out. It operates in a environment that the media does not treat the Democrats as kindly, the mainstream media, as, for example, the right-wing media treats conservatives. So they are not operating in necessarily the same playing field. But nevertheless, he's been a very successful president. And the average American, I think, is better off and will be better off. But we face immense challenges, and we face a clash of, I think, two very different visions of America. The perfect person to talk about those two visions of America, what I guess John, blanking on his name, you're gonna have to cut this part out. The two Americas, what John Edwards called the two Americas, is a man who has spent his life in unions and in Democratic politics, the former political director of the UAW, Michael Podhorzer. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You have taken a longer view than many analysts in trying to assess the time that we're in. Can you put in perspective where you think American politics sits right now? What is going on? What's the larger framework for understanding this election and the political time we find ourselves in?
Sure. I think the longer perspective is really one that has been built into the nature of the original agreement in the Constitution between two very different sets of states that formed this country at its inception. Those states drew on immigration from very different parts of Europe, from very different parts of the social structures in Europe, with very different ideas about the economy and all of those things. And so you had one region which was really invested in, obviously, in enslaving human beings and building an economy based on exploiting that labor for agriculture. And in that way, it was very much like Russia at that time, other places where that was the dominant economic model. And in the rest of the states, you had a much more cosmopolitan, forward-thinking, and more of a mixture of faiths and ethnic origins, and a need to figure out ways to work together. And you had sort of really there the birth of a democracy that is more that really revolutionary. And so I think that has carried through because you have, right, in our civic lessons, a declaration, an idea of America that comes from the Declaration of Independence, that we're one nation with a commitment to liberty and equality and the pursuit of happiness. And yet it didn't come together as a nation until there was a constitution that made sure that we actually couldn't accomplish those things. Because it was the only way the southern states would agree was to protect their right to human property. And we've been having different versions of the same battle almost ever since. And we can't really get out of it because the rigid federalism that this country is strapped to means that we are electing people who are representing those different regional perspectives and ways of life.
So
And yeah, go ahead.
in
In
short, we are still fighting the Civil War.
short.
We really have not come to terms with the original sin of slavery. And there is still a segment of the United States, we'll talk about majority minority in a moment,
Right.
but a significant segment of the United States that does not believe that the federal government should be supreme, that doesn't believe in immigration, that doesn't believe in a pluralistic society. And then the rest of us do. And
Right.
that is like a fundamental problem that keeps butting heads with one another. That's why you have the governor of Texas who's running his own immigration policy. Where did that come from? That's like
Right.
straight out of antebellum South.
Exactly.
So when the two sides or the two aspects of the country were reasonably balanced in terms of population, you kind of had a back and forth. Sometimes one side would win, sometimes the other. What we now have, and this gets into books like Tyranny of the Minority, is that if you look just at sheer population, the, if you will, the North, the
Right.
more cosmopolitan, pluralistic part of the country, has many, many more people. But it can't do things because the structure of that constitution that you alluded
Right.
to gives the minority such overwhelming power that that southern agrarian, hierarchical,
Right.
authoritarian part of the country gets. We have the dog, wag the tail wagging the dog here. What do we do about that clash? What do we do about that kind of paralysis that's almost built into our system now?
Right. I think that there's obviously 250 years later, I'm not going to give you an easy answer to that.
Really? I thought that's
Right,
what we had
it's
you
like
on for.
it just yeah. But I think but I am confident that the precondition for getting out of it is acknowledging that's what the problem is. Because as long as we continue to think this is about, individuals, all of us arguing with each other and just needing to be more civil and all of that, we are spinning our wheels while our country's being taken away from us, right? There's a way in which the red states, whatever we're going to call the Abbotts and so on, right? It's really important for us to understand that when he talks about the immigration being Texas's sovereignty, it isn't just a grab at something that sounds like a good argument today. That is the perspective they have, right? It's not like a good argument right now, right? It's not opportunistic. That is the way that their reasoning goes. And our almost stubborn refusal to recognize that within their mental framework, they feel just as right in what they're doing as we do. We keep getting surprised every time they do what is completely consistent with their worldview, right? And so we just, how many times have you heard, wow, they just keep breaking norms? No, they're not breaking their norms,
Yes.
right?
And their norms include this concept of white Christian nationalism,
Right.
that the proper order of things is that whites are in control, by and large, men are in control. And therefore, when they say they don't recognize America anymore, or they lash out against women trying to take away reproductive rights, they are saying the order of our society, of, if you will, the antebellum South, where it was
Right.
white men on top, then white women, then everybody else,
Sure.
that's being upset. And that's why they're so angry. That's why they're so convinced that by whatever means they need to hold power. Because if they
Right.
don't, Western civilization is destroyed. You're going to let these mongrel people, take over the United States. That's the mentality. And we think Trump is talking crazy stuff. He's effective with these people because he's saying exactly what they think.
Exactly. Then that's what's so important is to understand that Trump is leading a parade that's been marching for two centuries, right? And now has him as the leader for presidential elections. But almost everything that is being sort of talked about is what would happen if Trump won, to a large extent, has already happened in states with red trifectas. Right. And so we shouldn't view it as like very improbable. I mean, that's how almost half of Americans live right now.
Right.
Right. And it's they're just trying to like make it extend over the whole country. And to go back a minute to what sort of how you're talking about, I would say that the what characterizes the white Christian nationalism, right, that goes back to founding is the idea that there is already a biblically revealed correct way for societies to exist. And the purpose of government is to make sure we all follow those rules. And in the rest of the country and in much of Europe and in other democracies, the idea is that the purpose of government is really by letting people work it through with each other. We come to the best solution for all of us most of the time. But there isn't some, pre-existing right and wrong that the government is there to police.
And this is not just Mike and Jen saying this. They say this themselves. If you
Right.
remember Senator Scott, when he came out with his 11 planks, most of those were the natural order of God is one man, one woman. The natural
Right.
order of the universe is two genders. They were talking in biblical, terms. And by the way, when we say white Christian nationalism, we don't mean all Christians. We mean a specific brand of evangelical, mostly
Right.
Protestant, white Christians. So it's not like you and I are exaggerating. We're just taking them seriously. And I think it's important that people actually take them seriously. So when you get to issues in which there is such a disjunction between what these people want and what the overwhelming population wants, you see these kind of, it's almost like two tectonic plates rupturing. And I think today of abortion and reproductive rights. As we're sitting here on Tuesday, the Supreme Court has just heard an argument on the abortion drug. And you had two of the, I don't even want to say conservative, the
Yeah, you should
right-wing
never say
activists,
conservative. Yeah.
yes, justices, basically arguing we should use the Comstock Act, which was, a 100-plus old year statute that was supposed to prevent, prostitution and sending, porn through the mail, to use that to stop abortion
Right.
medication from getting to people. And so when you have this, it's kind of a stunning moment. When it breaks out into reality, When you see kind of the clash that has happened over abortion and the kind of public reaction to it, even in red states where they've had these referendum, what does that tell you about the ability of those red states, that kind of red state mentality, to control what's going on? And what is the ability of the rest of the country to really push back?
So it's really important if we start with the abortion, right? That because this makes it really clear what's going on is that the when Roe was overturned, several different really well-powered surveys showed that there wasn't a single state in the country where a majority of the people wanted to overturn Roe. So it's not as if the people in these red states are as extreme as as what's happening, right? What's happening is because the white Christian nationalist churches in the region are well positioned to basically capture the state legislatures and state office, right? So that even though they are a minority, even in red states, that perspective, they are very definitely a majority of all the red state legislative districts, of all the red congressional districts. And by virtue of being a majority of a minority, they actually get power because of the system, right? And for example, the way you get to Mike Johnson, right, is that in these congressional districts, the you only need about 50,000 votes to win a Republican primary. And so when you realize that the in those red districts, white evangelicals make up from 40 to 70% of the Republican primary vote, right? That's a lock. And that's why all of those districts are bright red and all are moving the country, well, like taking a bit, hijack the Republican caucus, basically.
And it's really important to drill down on that. We have so few competitive congressional districts because of gerrymandering that the action is all in the primaries. And when the action is in a Republican primary and turnout is very low because people say, oh, you know, who cares about a primary? Then you have a sliver of a sliver of a sliver who is picking the most extreme candidate. And then when they get into power, they're most concerned about the sliver of the sliver because that's the only threat they face. They're not going to get wiped out by the Democrat. They're not going to get wiped out by a more moderate Republican. They're going to get wiped out by someone even crazier than they are.
They
And so you
only have
have,
to worry about that.
exactly. Let me switch gears just a little bit because you, of course, have had a long storied career with organized labor. And talk to us a little bit about America's mass movements and mass small d democratic movements. I wrote a book about women reacting to Donald Trump. You've now seen a revival of the labor movement. Am I too starry-eyed in thinking that there is still a place in American society for very effective collective action, and when we get with our backs up against the wall, we still have the potential to kind of get things done if we do them in a collective manner, as opposed to just fighting, you know, this politician is bad, that politician is bad. Is there something that's still, you know, flowing through the veins of American democracy that we should be encouraged by?
Well, so I do think that if you're starry-eyed with four stars, I'll take it down to two. I think that if you think about the what you were calling the resurgence of the labor movement over these last couple of years and step back from it, you will see something really important, which is that the really important victories that were won were by the UAW, by the Teamsters at UPS, by the Writers Guild, right, by this by SAG. Those are existing unions. And when you look at the workplaces that are also exciting, like Amazon or Starbucks or Trader Joe's, they still have not even gotten to negotiations for a first contract because the nature of labor law in this country is such that we're still hanging on by a thread to the protections that accrue to the unions that came of age in the 1930s, like the UAW or the Teamsters or the writers, right? But really, there are almost no new big unions since then. Because after that burst of union activity from the early 30s to the 40s, business was very successful at closing the door on other working people getting a union for themselves, right? And a lot of it has been able to happen because especially since the 70s, the Democratic Party, which had been really going to bat for that, became more of a business party. And instead of seeing that there were going to be conflicts between workers' interests and management's interests, looked for ways of saying, like, there's just win-win, right? And so I think one really good example of the way without even thinking about it, people are sure don't see it, is with gig workers like Uber, right? Where we hear that from often Democratic Party voices, well, it's different in this new economy. They're gig workers, they value their freedom. We don't want unions were a thing of the past and all of that. But if you think about a set of workers who would really value their own individual genius and want the flexibility to do whatever they want, is your first thought the showrunner for Succession, or is it your Uber driver?
Yes.
Right? And yet, right, because writers, actors, and so on happened to create their union at a time that people understood it, we see what power they have. Right? So there's no reason that Uber drivers or other gig workers can't have an effective union other than that those companies quickly find ways to pass laws to prevent that from happening, to treat them as independent contractors. So to the take your four stars down to two until the rest of us, the people who are not in necessarily in unions, go from saying, wow, we really are rooting for our barista or for the Amazon warehouse worker, to realizing that our democracy depends on there being robust unions in this country, and that it's about more than, well, they deserve it, but that you can't have a robust, rich democracy if people aren't able to act easily in a collective way. And that's what's been eroded over the last 50 years.
I can't stress enough that things that we hear, well, it's impossible because, well, this person is management. He can't be in union. This person is an independent contractor.
Right.
That's not the way it has to be. There's no
Right.
like golden rule in heaven that says, well,
Exactly,
if you
right.
set up a contract and say, well, you're an independent contractor, you have to bring your own tools to work, you have to bring
Right.
your own car, you don't get the benefits. It's just the way things have been done. And it
Right.
doesn't mean it can't change.
Right.
And that's, I guess, the definition of being progressive. And frankly, it's also the definition of what used to be conservative. You conserve
Right.
what's good, and then you innovate and adapt to new circumstances. When you see movements like women and certainly some men who are turning out to put on the ballot in some very red states
Yeah.
Abortion access measures. When you see labor movements begin to get ginned up, is that a function of frustration with the existing system? Or is this something that Democrats and progressives have kind of learned over the years and it's more of a now kind of sharing what they've learned? In other words, is this a bottom-up phenomenon or is this a top-down phenomenon?
I've more bottom up, and I think that it's really interesting to see the like what a difference it makes if you're in a state where you do have access to ballot initiatives and ones you don't, right?
Right.
And that in red states and you know, on improbable places, initiatives sort of send up a flare that in fact the what we were talking about before, which is those the religious right has captured the electoral system, and it really is out of step where, with where people are in the state.
There is also a certain mentality, and if you know my work, I've migrated from center right to sort of center left or just centrist. And it's kind of a gene, I guess, that Democrats have. And it's terrific to be in my position because you can really observe like what they get right and what they get wrong. Republicans have a certain shamelessness. They have power, they're going to do the most they can possibly do with it. Democrats do not seem to have that same sense of the jugular. They don't seem, for example, you see the Senate. Why aren't they holding hearings on, Ivanka and, Jared? There is just, I'm not sure if it's a complacency or it's kind of a, Marcus of Queensberry kind of rules. What is it that explains this really kind of divergence in outlook about the sensibility of politics?
I think there are several things. I think one of the most important, though, is just the difference in the media ecosystems that both live in. Right. There's in right-wing media, no, there's no questioning of anyone for lying or for, right? I mean, there's a very clear story of what's going on in America in right-wing media, and that disciplines the Republican Party and is what holds it together and allows it to be ruthless in the way that you're describing, right? Because there's no one on, the editorial pages there saying, well, is, Jim Jordan going too far? Or, there's no conversation, there, right? The, like, we, everyone sort of in this other side ecosystem has been talking about nothing but polarization for how long? And in the right-wing media ecosystem, you don't hear anyone talking about polarization. You just hear them talking about how terrible people, how
The
terrible
communists
Democrats
on the
are.
left, everyone's a communist, everyone's a socialist, right?
Like none of them are worried about America being polarized, right? They see it because they see it that clearly. And then because that's the construct, they can behave, they do behave that way because to behave otherwise is actually to betray the story that your voters believe in, right? In the rest of the country, the press does what it should do in a democracy, which is provide a lot of different voices that are trying to come to some honest, good faith conversation about what ought to happen and what's right and what's wrong. And in that environment, it's really hard to be ruthless. Right. I mean, if you remember when right after we just had had January 6th, and then the red states were passing these onerous voter suppression bills to deal with non-existent fraud. And Biden comes out and says that's Jim Crow 2.0. And suddenly this media ecosystem is like, well, is it really Jim Crow 2.0? Is it right? I mean, it's like, and so, like, if you're a politician in that context, you really can't do what the Republicans do. That said, the example you used, I have no idea why they're not holding hearings on any of this stuff.
It's just, I mean, the Senate Democrats have me frustrated beyond belief
No
because
kidding.
you look at the imbalance. The House Republicans are holding absurd hearings on nothing, on made-up scandals. And when there is a scandal, the son-in-law of a former president who got $2 billion from the Saudis, no one's investigating that. I mean, this is absurd. And part of that, I think, is the difference between the House and the Senate, that the Senate is kind of this old boys' club and no one wants to ruffle others' feathers, although the Republicans have no problem ruffling Democrats' feathers at all. One of the fascinating things that I've seen on the press side, since I'm now part of the press, I've been part of the press, is this inability to discern that we're in a different time and place. There was an era in which, you know, what Heather Cox Richardson calls the, you know, sort of the consensus, the liberal consensus about liberal in the kind of non-political sense in terms of institutions, in terms of rule of law and so on. And if one party won, it wasn't great for your side, but it wasn't the end of civilization. And you had admirable people on one side and the other, and depending upon your political perspective, maybe more on your side than on the other side. But it wasn't the end of civilization. And there was sort of an equal distribution of lying and of misleading.
Right.
We're not in that era. And we have one side that is committed to distortion, to lies. And as, you know, my friend Jay Rosen says, it just fries the circuits of the media to understand that they can't say, well, on one hand, this guy says you should inject bleach, and the other one says you should get your inoculation. Right. You know, that's not acceptable when one side is doing deliberate harm to the public. How do you think Democrats should approach the media? And what's your view of Democrats going on, for example, Fox or in right-wing media? How do they deal both with their own media, which is sometimes paralyzed by this false balance, and also going into hostile territory to try to reach perhaps some people who are still persuadable?
Yeah. So I actually think that we should not think of this as the Democrats' job to do. I think this is our job to do. I think it's civil society's job to do. And a big part of how we got here is a kind of withdrawal from civic life by forces other than the two parties, and sort of devolving into an idea of democracy as a blood sport between two sets of campaign operatives and policy, like campaign ads and all of that, when like that was supposed to be for our benefit as citizens, right? And we really need to step up, and that does get to what Jay and others say about what the media needs to do, right? The media's warrant is the First Amendment, and you know, Jefferson saying, you know, rather have kindred exactly, but essentially it's more important to have a free press than anything. But that comes with the responsibility of protecting the democracy. And somehow protecting the democracy has gone from telling the truth to narrating a battle between two political parties.
Right.
And for most people, and we're sort of seeing this but not acknowledging it, for like about half the country, neither party really speaks for people anymore. And so, but that just gets like pushed under the rug. Right. And so I don't want to have to depend on Democrats doing the right thing. Right. I want all of us to realize that at this inflection point in our history, we all have to do something. Right. And that religious leaders, the media leaders, others have to step up and say, we don't want any part of this partisan debate, but we do want to say that if this, you know, Project 2025 gets implemented, like your future is going to be very much shriveled up, right? And that, and it's really just having a place Americans can get the truth about what's going on.
Right. One of the things that I tell people frequently is that you can always count on big business to cut deals with fascists. They have always done so. And so when you see big business after about 3 months return to giving money to Republicans, when you see Jamie Dimon trying to defend Trump's economic policies, like these were so
right.
Fabulous. Don't you remember the glory days? No, I don't. That this is the way they cut deals. So expecting certain elements of society to act in a longer term interest by saying, you know, if you were a rational person in Jamie Dimon's spot, you would say, listen, I am successful because we live in a democracy with a rule of law that allows the country to provide me with educated workers and rules that I can do my business by and I can make a profit. But they tend not to do that. They tend to say, I want that tax cut, and what else can we deregulate? Do you think that the Democratic Party has gotten tough enough with business? Do you think that they have bought into, for example, tax rates that are still really, really low? I mean, we're talking about crumbs here. We're talking about pleading with 50 companies to pay any tax. We're not talking about, 70% tax rates. Have they set their expectations too low?
Well, so I think I actually want to go back to what you're saying about business always cutting deals with fascists, because that's not really true, right? I think that what's most important, I think, to the business community, which is why they were where they were in 2020, is stability, right? They don't care whether that stability comes from an authoritarian regime, a fascist regime, or a democratic regime, as long as what they're getting is stability in the society. And if you remember, in the summer of 2020, we had the George Floyd protests and a real sort of vivid demonstration of what might happen if Trump were able to get away with overturning the results. And in that moment, right, that was the decision that made sense to that capitalist class, was, right, that stability. And what I think they feel now is that, on the one hand, Biden has actually been more aggressive than they anticipated and more successful at it, and that there's not much risk that if Trump wins again, fair and square, that there'll be less social unrest from it. And so now that looks like a better deal to them.
So they don't look at the 2025 and say, oh my God, this is a recipe for chaos, disaster, corruption on a grand scale. That doesn't permeate their thinking?
No, because I think they, and this is where, people are, I think, properly drawing, pretty scary analogies to the 30s in Italy and Germany, where the business people thought that they would be able to control what was going on and had an exaggerated sense of their own power. And that's what I think is where we're heading to the same thing, right? But I think, since you're bringing up business, I think one of the really interesting things to when we look at what the Supreme Court's been doing, right, is to understand that in that coalition that's been the Republican Party between corporate and religious right, corporate does not want religious right to get more power. And that's why you get sometimes decisions that our folks see as, oh my God, they actually do believe in democracy, like in Moore v. Harper on the independent state legislature. No, they just think that those like red state legislatures that have been going after local companies for diversity or whatever already have enough power, right? And so that's where they realize that giving them more power isn't to their advantage. But that said, I think they feel like they have a majority on the court, and that will protect them against Trump.
Fascinating and scary.
Yeah.
So let's say we don't have a catastrophe. Let's say Biden wins, the House goes Democratic, and maybe even they run the table and it's sort of a 50-50 kind of Senate. What do you think at that point Democrats should do to try to, not only in terms of individual policy decisions, but do to try to bolster democracy itself, to try to institutionalize some things that over the long term will help recalibrate society in a way that's more small d democratic?
Sure. I think the most important things are going to be, and this is why this election cycle is even more important than your people are thinking about, is that first they need to, put aside the filibuster finally and pass legislation like Freedom to Vote, which at least brings most of the like, undoes a lot of the what has happened in red states. But there's also going to be potentially an opportunity to change the balance on the Supreme Court because Alito and Thomas will be 78 and 80 by the end of this next term, which is why it's kind of harrowing to think about a second Trump term where they get replaced by, I don't know, embryos or something that'll have us. With them on the court
Yes.
until somewhere in the mid 22nd century, and where they're putting more judges like Cannon and Kaczmarek throughout the whole judicial system, right? And so shoring all of that up is going to be important, but there's a lot of work to do. It's not, and the this is a permanent feature, this contest, and it's going to take, civil society to step up and demand that we come up with better ways of selecting our leaders and expressing democracy.
What would you favor on the court? Do you favor expanding the court? There's no magic to 9 seats. Or do you favor term limits? Do you favor one and then the other? What's your sense of the best approach?
Yeah, I don't. I think that the I have a different perspective on that and a lot of other kinds of issues, and perhaps this comes from having a very long career in politics that doesn't really involve being in the Democratic Party, but being on the outside, is that, what really should get covered is the ways in which powerful outside groups figure out how to hack the system,
Yep.
right? And no matter what you do to reform, it's not like business is going to say, "Darn, I guess they have us now," right? They're gonna try to figure it out, and it's a you kind of have to keep revising it. So I don't think there's like the issue is as that we got to rack our brains on is procedural as much as it is figuring out how to make it more difficult for those interests to take over the selection of our judges, right?
And so you don't think judges should go on expensive vacations with people who appear before the court, and that these people who have taken them on vacation should come up with special groups to come up with cases and devise lawsuits to bring before the judges they have taken on vacation? I mean, this is the way it's done, Mike. You're so
Yeah, I
old-fashioned.
know. Although I think, actually, this may sound like apostasy, but that's the least of it,
Yeah, no,
right?
it's you are
Because,
absolutely right.
right, because it's not like they need those perks to do what they're doing. That's not like why they're doing this, right? They, especially because of the whole system of the Federalist Society, they are on the court because they can be depended on to bring this agenda to what the court does. And as human beings, they've become extremely careless in revealing like who they see as their peers and what who they want to hang out with. But I don't think Alito needs to go on a fishing trip to take away your right to an abortion,
Right.
right?
That's the tell. That's not the motivation. The tell
Right.
is that these are his people, that his
Right.
constituents
Right.
are these people.
Right. And that this is what he like, he's just too brazen about it. And
Yes.
one of the problems I have with sort of the Democratic or progressive reform community is this really naive, dependent belief in things like disclosure and in just trying to write rules that are going to deal with it without recognizing this is really just a contest of power, and you have to deal with what gives them power. right? I mean, this last in 2020, the federal elections cost $14 billion, right? And how many stories have you seen about campaign finance other than using it to say, oh, well, that candidate's a better one than the other one because they can raise more money, as opposed to the purpose of the disclosure laws was to say, hey, you want to know why we don't have, Medicaid price negotiation? Like it never, like you, there's, we get
No
all these,
connecting the dots.
right? We get all these stories about how Republicans are this demographic and, oh, look, it just moved an inch in this group for Democrats. And there are no stories about the corporate sectors that back each side, right? And how that has such an influence on what both parties do.
Public financing and the reform of the entire structure of how we raise money is a locus of many of these problems, whether it's the Supreme Court, which then finances these campaigns, whether it's putting people who, have their ear to the ground for special interests. When we had Citizens United come out, and many people said, many people like you and others warned this is going to be terrible. You heard this kind of refrain, oh, it's not going to be that bad. It'll just it, this is just democracy. It's just the First Amendment. What now do you see that has happened to the political parties and frankly, even the strength of labor unions as an actor in the political parties because of Citizens United?
Oh, it's just immense, right? But and it also gets to a point that I think is really important, right? Because if you think about our politics being driven by the major political powers in the country as opposed to the individual actors who are on the stage for the Democrats and Republicans, right? Then you see that citizen all the changes in our democracy that the Supreme Court, that Federalist Society majority by 5-4 did, Citizens United, unlimited money, Rousseau, unlimited gerrymandering, Shelby, get rid of the Voting Rights Act, right? None of that could have happened through Congress. None of that could have happened through a democratic process. And so the interests behind the Federalist Society have an integrated plan, right? They change the rules, and then as they change those rules, you get red state MAGA trifectas that are financed by the people who are now liberated by Citizens United, who run from districts that are now completely safe because of Rousseau, and that are impervious to creating the kind of bi cross-racial coalitions that for a brief moment after the passage of the Voting Rights Act actually got us people like Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton or Lawton Childs, right? When there was when the government stepped in and made sure that it was a level playing field there, or more level playing field, suddenly you had democracy starting there. But all that got shut down by the Federalist Society part of it, right? And the Federalist Society Party gets to do that because the congressional part of it uses the filibuster to prevent Congress from reacting to any of those decisions. And so that makes those five and now six justices the actual Congress of the United States, right? And without even needing a presidential signature, right? And they just are doing their agenda.
So if you were running the Democrats campaign in 2024, what would be like the two or three big ideas that you would be presenting to the country that kind of capture these issues and that you think are going to be most effective getting through to people who maybe are not the most engaged in politics, those kind of disengaged people who sometimes show up every 4 years, sometimes not, and who don't think of themselves politically, but who play an awful big role in our politics. What would you say should be the message out there that would be most effective?
I think what's more important than the message, because I think, I mean, again, this is like when you say it in one sentence, it seems kind of silly. But if the problem Democrats have right now is double haters, like the idea that, that people who don't believe in Biden or the Democrats are really going to believe any message coming from them is really problematic, right? It's what you had raised earlier in the podcast, which is they need to be doing hearings on these things, right? They need to be doing their job that they were elected to do, right? Which is really make clear in the way they were able to at the January 6 hearings, what's going on in the country. And I think messaging is very secondary to all of that, right? I think we're in an era where it isn't slogans that are winning elections, it's what people believe is happening in the country and what's real and what's not, and what's a real threat and not. And that's job of media, it's job of religious leaders, job all of us to make sure that we're taking this seriously.
And when you talk to union members, and they kind of look at the economy as a whole, do they sense the peril we're in? One of the things I worry about is even people who are part of the traditional Democratic coalition don't have the sense of urgency, the sense that this could literally be like the last election that we could ever have. What do you hear from them, and how do you give them that sense of urgency, or kind of put up the neon lights and say, "Danger, Will Robinson, danger."
So I think there are a couple of things. First is that unions still are fairly successful at that. Remember that people who are, unlike other groups that get lumped as progressive organizations, people don't join unions because of their political views. They're in unions because of where they work. And study after study shows that they support MAGA Republicans, whatever you want to call it, at a much lower rate than people with the same demographics and all of that. But still, a substantial portion do. And I think part of it is because they also live in this world and in these information systems. And I think that for many union members for whom the union itself is not not conclusively credible, they need to hear from other sources that what their union steward is telling them is true, right? I remember a really important experience for me, and I was the political director and did politics in the labor movement, was in 2004, as we were looking at what issues matter to union members, right? Social Security is always one of the most important issues. And Bush had said he wanted to privatize Social Security. But when we tested that in a pretty scientific way with members and so on, it really didn't move the needle at all. Why didn't it move the needle? Because they didn't believe that anyone would really do that, right? You gets reelected, he actually starts to do it, and all those union members who still voted for him because they didn't believe us, were out there at town halls. They were going after the members of Congress. They were completely activated. Right. And so that really gets at how it isn't like we couldn't have found a different message about Social Security. It was, did they believe it? Right. In the same way, for like a generation almost, it was impossible to say for progressives to say you really have to care about this judicial nomination because they're going to overturn Roe. Right. When Roe was overturned, it wasn't like that changed a lot of people's minds about whether Roe was important, but it changed everybody's mind about whether it could be overturned. Right? And that is the firestorm.
Interesting. And you could say the same for the Affordable Care Act,
Right.
that, they had been saying for years other Republicans could get rid of it. And then when they've actually finally did it, you also had Republicans whose hair was on fire because, my God, they looked at these, you know, numbers and they said, oh, my God, I'm going to lose my health care. I thought it was just Obamacare. Right. You know, there was no connection between what they were voting for and what they heard on TV and like their own lives. So I think sometimes the kind of visceral connection when I see Democrats talk about these mega, you know, numbers, you know, 15 million jobs created, you know, these national figures, that just, I think, doesn't hit home with people. What does it mean to me? Why is my life going to be crappy or better, depending upon what I do? So I think, you know, that's a very kind of basic concept in politics. So as you sit here today, are you optimistic about the future of America or not?
I am clear-eyed. I think, you know, there we are a nation of many contradictions, of a lot of unforced errors in how we govern ourselves. But I think that if we regain the habit of acting collectively, of seeing what we have in common to like to express sort of collective power, we can do better than we are now. But that has to happen.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mike. It has been a fascinating conversation. We'll keep an eye out and we'll have you back to see if we're going to have future elections or if this is the last one.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Wow, that was a fascinating conversation on everything from the Civil War to union politics to the Federalist Society. But I think Mike's right. You have to kind of look at the totality of these things and keep your eye on the larger picture. I think the larger picture is fundamentally, what kind of America do we want? Do we want one that is hierarchical, that is racially imbalanced, and in which certain groups have a place at the top and have disproportionate power? Or are we really going to live up to this ideal of a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multiracial democracy? And in democracies, the government is supposed to be responsive to the people, not to a sliver of a sliver that gets to vote in certain primaries, not to the titans of industry that control millions and millions of dollars and help elect senators and help, therefore, fund campaigns to put people on the court. That basic conflict between what kind of America we want that has never really been resolved, it hasn't been resolved racially, hasn't been resolved economically, is once again confronting us. And when you have someone as dangerous, as manipulative as Donald Trump, who can tap in so closely to the American id, to the worst instincts, and to a vision of America that is antithetical to many of us, we come to a crisis point, and that is where we are. So when you talk to friends who say, oh, it doesn't matter who's in power or both parties are cruddy, you have to really lay it out for them. Do they want to live in a country in which all abortion is outlawed? Do they want to live in a country in which the largest corporations, the wealthiest Americans, literally pay no taxes? Do they want to live in a society in which there are no limitations whatsoever on guns? Do they want to live in a country in which religious fundamentalists occupy public space? These are the people who want to have chaplains in public schools. Let me tell you, for my Jewish friends, it's not going to be your local Reform rabbi. It's not going to be that person who's going to be in the schools. So I think we have some fundamental decisions about where we're going. And I think it's no exaggeration to say that the future of small d democracy is at stake. Things like book banning, that's been part and parcel of the Republican message. And they keep telling us. They keep telling us what they want. They spell it out in the Republican budget. They spell it out in the 2025 plan. They tell us what they want to do, and we should start believing them. So Mike is right that collective action has always been the answer. It was the answer to gross economic inequality when the labor movement began. It was the answer to racial inequality in the civil rights movement. And it continues to be the glue, I think, that will hold us together. So that means volunteering. That means engaging with your neighbors. That means giving of your time and money to causes that promote a communal solidarity. And that means trying to maintain an optimistic outlook, because of course, depression, despondency, that's what dictators have always counted on, that it will all be too much, too frightful, too depressing, and therefore you're just going to kind of curl up in a ball and forget about it. We don't have that luxury. So I hope you enjoyed the program. If you did, please tell your friends. They can follow us and subscribe on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.